Now we've got some cards, I think, that we've passed out in the other room. Is that right, David? Yeah, but we'll start in here. Has anybody in here got a question? Sir.
I wrote it down. CEO
can you wait? Just wait for the microphone.
Oh. Well, interestingly enough, Smith distrusted corporate structure. He didn't like the corporate structure. It's interesting that the supposed avatar of modern capitalism would have been looked at the corporate structure, the normal, what we would consider a normal corporate structure, and said, that is a bad idea. The way you've spread ownership so thinly and left these people in management in control of this corporation, they're going to run the corporation for their benefit because most of the people who are invested in this are, don't know enough about the business and don't have enough control over the business to have anything really to say about this. And I think one of the miracles of modern capitalism is that the corporate structure that we are accustomed to works as well as it does, that it works at all. I think that the corporate the CEO compensation is probably out of control. How hard can it be? You're the head of Procter & Gamble, right? Population's getting older. You go, let's see. Population's getting older. More gel you sell, less shampoo. Less hair conditioner, more. That's what they do all day. It's not like they lift stuff, And you got to figure that especially the way a lot of them have behaved, say, at our American automobile companies. You tell me you can't snatch somebody at random from an MBA program that couldn't do that badly, for a lot less money, I don't see it. The problem, of course, is as it often is with anything that any kind of problem is, the minute you announce this problem to political powers, they say, we can fix this. We'll just pass a law. And the cure is going to be worse than the disease. You're going to essentially, we don't have very good corporate management right now, but it could get a lot worse if the government gets to appoint the people who manage a corporation. So I think it's one of those things that the best answer is, shareholder activism the best answer is through civil society, whatever sort of action you can take as an investor. Any of us who are, and of course, we all are investors because almost everybody in this room is of an age where we've got some pension investment of some kind. So we're all investors, and we're not living up to our responsibilities when we let these people do this. And we've got to take the whip hand here. If we turn it over to Hillary and Barack Obama, it's going to be a lot worse. Oh, here's a question from the other room. From the mysterious people in the other room. If Smith had written The Wealth today, wouldn't he have added rule of law as a necessity for economic progress? Well, in point of fact, he did. I didn't talk about it tonight, but that was a central tenet of Smith. Smith was a firm believer in rule of law. And to the extent that he went so far as to say that it's better to have a set of imperfect set of laws, even a fairly bad set of laws, as long as those laws are applied equally to everyone in society, and as long as the members of society have some input and influence over what those laws are, it's better to have those laws than to have no law. And that, I think, we can see that. It isn't hard to get an example of that. Burma would be a lousy place to live. We certainly wouldn't want to live there, but we'd probably want to live in Burma before we'd want to live in Somalia. It's better to have bad laws than no laws. No, he was a huge believer. Smith, one of the things that keeps Smith from being a libertarian in certain ways, even though he's inspired libertarianism, is that Smith was, lived in an era where lawlessness was very, in Western Europe and in our civilization, was very in recent memory and very close at hand. He was a college student at Oxford when the last Highland Rising happened. And those people of his era had an enormous fear of lawlessness, were willing to give up some of considerable amount of what we would consider civil liberties in order to ensure that they didn't live in a lawless society. Another question? Right next to you. Right in front of you. Look to your right. Right there, guy in the blue shirt. There you go.
Thank you. Hi. Oh, yeah, do you believe that capitalism leads naturally to greater political and social freedom? And if so, how do you explain Singapore?
Do I think that capitalism leads naturally to... No, I don't think we can.
Do you believe that capitalism leads naturally to greater political and social freedom? And if so, how do you explain Singapore?
Do I think that capitalism leads... naturally to... No, I don't think capitalism does. Capitalism has existed forever. There were capitalists in ancient Rome. No, free markets do seem to tend to lead to... And property rights. Probably a tremendous, wonderful book by Richard Pipes, the Russian historian, called Property and Freedom, where he basically proves the case, I think, or I guess comes as close as you can, is that property rights are the necessary foundation for political freedom. And certainly a free market can't exist very well without property rights. So now, because property rights don't necessarily mean that you will have political freedoms, but they're necessary in order for you to get So it's possible to have certainly possible to have a capitalistic system, and it's possible even to have a free market system that doesn't have political rights. But if you don't get that free market system, then you will never get the political rights, because a free market system is necessary. It's fundamentally, the reason here is that you have to create a large enough base of people who have material influence over a society to counterweight those people who have the weight of force, the weight of tradition, the weight of political or economic, political or religious fanaticism. So the only way to create a counterweight for freedom against the traditional forces of tyranny is for there to be a broad section of society with a lot of economic... create a counterweight for freedom against the traditional forces of tyranny is for there to be a broad section of society with a lot of economic throwaway. And this is basically how Europe became free, how Europe went from the feudal era to an era of reasonable freedom. And, it is our big hope for China. We don't know if it'll work, but without that free market step that the Chinese have taken, we can be pretty sure that they would have slid right back into, acting like Russia. In your opinion, which is the most Smithian country in the modern world? In other words, which country is the closest to Smith's model? Well, up until the reunion of Hong Kong with China, I would have said Hong Kong. Hong Kong, even though it wasn't a democracy, it had... You got to remember, Smith was not a Democrat. I don't mean a capital D Democrat. Of course he wasn't a capital D Democrat. That would have been ridiculous. But he wasn't a small D Democrat. And, of course, there was a reason. There really weren't many small-D Democrats, and there was a reason for that in the 18th century. Democracy had not been tried. Not been tried on a broad scale. All the people in the 18th century knew about democracy was, their knowledge was a couple thousand years old. It was Athens, Peloponnesian War. They all knew the history of the Peloponnesian War. Long, complicated war can be easily summarized. Democratic Athens screwed up, And tyrannical Sparta won. And so all down for 2,000 years of history, people are going, woo, a wonderful idea, but, it didn't seem to work out very well in Athens. Then the other examples of democracy that a person of Smith's era would be familiar with would be the cantons of Switzerland, where Calvin had burned people at the stake for saying there wasn't a Trinity and that kind of thing. The little city-state republics of Italy, where everybody was poisoning everybody else. So far, the experiment and what experiments there have been in democracy didn't look too promising. State republics of Italy, where everybody was poisoning everybody else, Smith believed in democratic principles, there's no doubt, but he thought that about as best you could do would be a limited monarchy with a serious counterweight having to do with people of property in a parliament. And he knew about the United States, but he was very dubious about our prospects. There's 13 little quarrelsome country, you know, mini countries, nationettes, you know, all at each other's throats, and with a bunch of ridiculous paper money that wasn't worth anything, and it didn't look good, you know. And of course, in certain ways, like, it didn't look good over here as a democracy until we, you know, sort of settled up certain scores in the Civil War. You know, it wasn't really until we got through the Civil War that we proved that democracy could work on a broad basis. We got right here in the front. Let's make the microphone person. Let's make her earn her keep.
Why are American newspapers and broadcast journalism so liberal?
Okay, where it comes to the left-wing bias or the liberal bias in the media, and it exists. It exists. You know, I mean, all you have to do is move from the business to the arts pages in the Wall Street Journal to see that it exists. You know, it exists because of the kind of people who go into newspaper work. Now, I'm old enough to remember the kind of people who used to go into newspaper work. You know, a newspaper used to be a trade. It was basically a semi-skilled trade. If you were a kid, and it wasn't drawn from newspaper people weren't drawn from fancy backgrounds. They mostly grew up in blue-collar neighborhoods. They were mostly Catholic. They grew up Catholic. A lot of them were Irish. They grew up in these neighborhoods, and if you liked books and you didn't like lifting things for a living and you didn't want to get up real early in the morning, you basically had two choices in life. You could either become a newspaper reporter or you could go into the church, you know. So it's all these guys going, all these young guys who liked to read and were, you know, and didn't like to lift things, going, you know, women, booze. Women or booze, you know, which is a church or newspaper, you know. And so when you met the old-fashioned newspaper guys, they were guys, of course. They were just regular guys. They didn't have like this, they didn't have a big sense of their job. They just they were paid professional gawkers. They were the guys who got to go on the other side of the yellow police tape, you know. There'd be a terrible car wreck, and their job was to go in on the other side of the police tape and look in there and go, oh, man, that was a terrible car wreck. My head was smashed like a pumpkin, you know. And then come out and tell us about it, you know. It was a great job. You got free hockey tickets. There were poker games, you know. You got to smoke and drink, and it was great, you know. Then comes the professionalization of journalism. And pretty soon you got a college degree in journalism. A lot of old fashion reporters never finished high school, you know. And all of a sudden you got a college degree, and you start getting a sort of a different type in there. And they start thinking they've got a mission, you know. They're not just laying bricks, you know. They've got a mission to make the world better. And that trend had started already in the 1950s and in the 1960s, but then something awful happened. It was Watergate. And not really that Watergate was so awful. It was the movie that was made about Watergate. And all of a sudden, every little drip who should have joined the Peace Corps goes to J school, you know, because they're going to be played by Robert Redford. They're always going to be played by Robert Redford, never Dustin Hoffman for some reason. They're always going to be played by Robert Redford. And they're going to Peace Corps goes to J school, you know, because they're going to be played by Robert Redford. They're always going to be played by Robert Redford, never Dustin Hoffman for some reason. They're always going to be played by Robert Redford. And they're going to change the world, and they're going to speak truth to power. And that's the kind of, and now you go into a city room at a newspaper. When I was a kid starting out in the business, you went into the city room in a newspaper. It was blue with smoke, and everybody's beating on typewriters, and they're yelling for the copy boys, and they got the bottle down in the bottom right-hand desk drawer. You go in now, it's all carpeted, and everybody's tippy-tippy-tippy-tapping, making little phone calls, you know, and it's and it's, you know, and the air is fresh as a daisy, and everybody's busy speaking truth to power, you know. And just got taken over by wimps is what happened, you know? Have we got an other room card? It's there we go. I'm sorry. Did Smith get anything wrong about the economy? Really wrong. Well, yeah, he did the beaver thing that I was talking about. You know, it's all wrong about beaver. He obviously never been outdoors in his life. He's a scholarly guy. You know, he didn't know what he's talking about. It was actually Tom Palmer at Cato Institute that pointed that out to me, because I asked Palmer the same question when I started this project, because Palmer really is a scholar of Smith. And I said, Tom, was he really wrong about anything? He said, oh, yeah. You know, he's seriously wrong. But even more so, there are five books to The Wealth of Nations, and the fifth book is particularly interesting in some ways because it's the worst of the five books. The second book has some problems with value and price, and it has some problems with the nature of capital accumulation and so on, some things that we might well disagree with. But the fifth book is when Smith takes his basic principles and he tries to apply them to policy questions of the British government in the 18th century, and he just goes haywire. He's internally inconsistent. He contradicts himself and argues with himself. He violates his own principles with his suggestions. Some of these suggestions make no sense whatsoever. It is a great reminder that politics can turn anyone into an idiot. You know? Here is one of the provably one of the smartest people to have ever lived, and when he takes on practical politics, he turns into an idiot. You know? Here is one of the provably one of the smartest people to have ever lived, and when he takes on practical politics, he turns into a jerk, you know, in certain ways. And so, and you know, Smith originally had planned three books. He had this big project he was going to do. He was going to deal with our moral existence. That's the Theory of Moral Sentiments, an absolutely brilliant book. That is about how we, using just a tool, basically, of some natural sympathy that we seem to be able to feel, we use that and build upon that to build moral structures. And it talks about how we build moral structures and how we can judge whether our moral judgments are indeed valid and how we can make better moral judgments and how those judgments are corrupted by build moral structures. And it talks about how we build moral structures and how we can judge whether our moral judgments are indeed valid and how we can make better moral judgments and how those judgments are corrupted by fashion and corrupted by circumstances. So absolutely brilliant book. In many ways, definitely an easier read in The Wealth of Nations, and in many ways less dated because it's about human nature, and that, of course, doesn't change whatsoever. Then he was going to do a book about our material circumstances, and that's The Wealth of Nations. And his idea was to do a third book about our political circumstances, our law and politics, what he called jurisprudence. And that book he never did. And we don't know quite why he didn't do that. We do know that not too long before he died, when he knew he was dying, he had all his notes and drafts and work that he did on the book about jurisprudence burned. And so we have no idea what was going to be in that book. But I think there's a clue. I think there was something else going on. I mean, you know, Smith didn't live terribly long. His health was not great. He was busy doing other things. But there are many reasons that the book might not have gotten written. But I think that there is a clue to one other possible reason in the last book of the Wealth of Nations, is that Smith realized, you know, the futility of trying to deal with politics. And that was, it's politics. He's a moral philosopher. There's not much room for philosophy, and there's no room for morals. You know, so. We are changing tapes on that. Or that's not really a tape, is it? It's a mysterious electronic thing, a thing I don't understand. Certainly not film, which is my inclination. No. Yeah, that's right, division of labor and rational ignorance. I don't have to know what he's doing back there. It's great. It's cool. You tell me when we're live again. Okay, in the back. Where's our microphone? Yeah, now I'm going to make it run all the way to the back. All the way to the back on the aisle there. A rational decision would have been to ask him first, then you, but, you know, never mind.
Did Adam Smith deal with taxation?
Oh, yeah, Adam Smith deals extensively with taxation. That's one of the areas where he goes quite badly wrong. In the fifth book, or not wrong, but I mean, he starts thinking about taxation. And he starts coming up with suggestions for taxation. He just can't help himself. You know, he's one of those guys that has to analyze everything. And so after The Wealth of Nations is published, the government of Britain looks at this book, and what do they take away from this book? You know, he makes all these amazing, important suggestions about how to improve, like trade, and how the country can get richer. And all they fix on are the couple of suggestions that he made about taxes. And he wasn't even suggesting that taxes should be raised. He believed in low taxes. But he mentioned taxes. And this is like, you know, this is like telling the dogs to stay out of the garbage. What do they hear? Garbage. All right. So, like, the first effect that The Wealth of Nations has politically is that a number of these sort of things he tossed off about, he said, when it comes to taxing, you know, you can't tax transitions you don't know about, but some transitions are public and notorious, and so those could be taxed. For instance, things sold at auction are sold publicly, so we know about, you know, we know when they were sold and how much for. So the government goes, oh, tax auctions, and on it went. And this was one of the reasons that Smith was given a job by the government, and he was given a job as a customs commissioner. He who had spent his whole life arguing down trade barriers was given a job at the end of his life as a customs commissioner. You know, it's typically, you know, that's politics for you. You know, politics always rewards us for our sins, you know. And, of course, Smith's family had been in that business. His father had been a customs agent, one of his cousins and an uncle and stuff. So he probably didn't think it was quite amusing as we think it is, you know, but nonetheless. Let's see. Did Smith believe fiat currency, or as some say, fiat currency? I've never known. What do you, David? Fiat, fiat, fiat. Yeah. I always think of like little cars, little cars full of money, little cars full of Italian lira driving around. Did Smith believe that fiat currency could be used successfully in a free market? Well, he didn't. He couldn't quite. He believed in money, in paper money. He thought that paper money would be, if properly controlled by an independent central bank, so that we didn't have inflation or credit collapses. He thought that that could be very valuable in an economic situation, because use of precious metals as money has a lot of inefficiencies. I mean, the stuff is heavy and clumsy, and you know, gets lost and it's easily stolen, and so on and so forth. Anyway, and plus, precious metals have actual practical industrial uses, which using them as money is where we're diverting them from. So he was in favor of paper money, but he couldn't quite get the idea of fiat money was just a little bit beyond him. He assumed that money would always have some sort of exchangeable basis. He even went so far as to posit a sort of market basket basis for the value of currency. The idea that currency would just be a government IOU, just sort of hanging out there, was like too much for an 18th century mind to wrap itself around. And I got to say, it's a little too much for my mind to wrap itself around down to this day. Sir, you were, yes, okay. So make you run around to them.
I wanted to ask you about what. I wanted to ask you about what Adam Smith would, what his views would be. 80% of the wealth is held by 10% of the population of Guatemala, mainly because of land grants given by the Spanish. Would Smith consider this property to be a sacred right?
He would. Smith would probably consider that Guatemalan property situation to be not worth fixing. I mean, he would consider the property rights to be more important than the inequitable distribution of property. And Smith, his message to the Guatemalans would be, wake up and smell the coffee, go to school, learn how to do something. You're not going to make a living as a farmer anyway. You know, it's Guatemala. What are you going to grow? You know, I mean, you got a little bit of coffee and a couple of bananas and get out of here, you know, go to high school, you know, and learn to count and stuff, you know. That this is not the way to the future, you know. I mean, and that's the problem with a lot of the third world. They think, oh my gosh, you know, I mean, things are so terribly unequal here. We have to split up this stuff and make it equal. Well, that doesn't work. What makes these countries rich is people acquiring skills and building businesses, not taking the patron's banana plantation and dividing it into 250 different little parcels where each person gets to grow one banana. I mean, that's not going to make people rich, you know. So, it's a lousy situation, and it's terribly unfair, but fixing it, okay, and then consider what it would take to fix that problem. It would take some sort of Guatemalan dictatorship. They're pretty familiar with that down there, you know. I mean, it would take concentrated government power to take that private property away from people and redistribute it fairly. Do you think it would get redistributed fairly? Well, no, of course not. It would go to the political cronies of the political people in charge. Plus, you would have to create this sort of Hugo Chavez centralized political power which would be, even if not abused by the people who created it, and believe me, that would be unlikely, would be definitely be abused by the people who inherited it or who worked within it and so on. So it would, again, it would be just one of those cures worse than the disease, you know. I mean, he wouldn't approve, you know, but the, you know, the way to fix that is for the Guatemalans to become a modern society and to give up on being an agrarian society. It's not, that's the only answer. Let's see, paradox. Adam Smith believed in, let's see, he believed in bad handwriting, apparently. No. This is really having trouble here. Believed in self. Adam Smith believed in self-interest, but he gave away lots of money. Where? What type of charities did he favor? Smith, we didn't find this out until quite late in Smith's, until the 1930s, really. It was guessed by, Smith lived quite modestly. He was never married. He had no children. He did help raise an orphaned cousin. He supported his mother and a maiden aunt. But he lived, he had a modest establishment. He entertained modestly. And he made a good deal of money in his life. And when he died, there wasn't much of an estate left. And his friends suspected that he'd given it a lot of it away. But we didn't really get proof until some letters came up for auction in the 1930s. And that's letters were sent to Smith, essentially to Smith's business manager, where he was writing to say that, you know, there was a cousin of his from Wales who was in the army that needed. It was a huge amount of money. It's like 2/3 of his pension for the year that he needed that, so he wouldn't have to give up his army commission and so on and so forth. So we really don't know where a lot of the money went, but it seems as though Smith gave away a great deal, and very secretly and very privately. There is a Talmudic saying that who gives in secret gives twice, and Smith was definitely up on that. Self-interest, that is self-interest. Smith points out in the theory of moral sentiments that the thing which motivates people most, which is most important to people, is to be beloved. And you know, even if the people who don't know who to beloved exactly, you know, they know that some nice guy somewhere fixed something for them. You know? So you know, self-interest in Smith is not monetary. Self-interest is very, very broadly defined. Self-interest is more what we would call self-actualization. I guess is what they would call it on the Oprah show. You know, live the best life, live your best life, or something like that. That's much more what he's talking about than simply accumulating cash. Right over there. Sir.
Our two major political parties, are they moving away from Smith with equal speed, or is one still better than the other?
I think the Democrats are quicker on their feet than the Republicans in a general sort of way. I think that the Republicans, bad as they are, and they've been extraordinarily bad over the course of this president's administration, do not subscribe to the zero-sum fallacy. And I do think, in their heart of hearts, the Democrats do. I say this is what keeps me, you know, at least nominally or notionally a Republican, and it keeps me from ever being able to support, I find it very, very difficult to support a Democratic candidate, because I do think that the root of the Democratic Party is a belief in the zero sum, and I mean they certainly talk as though everything is zero sum, and I think that they really feel that way in their hearts. And of course, it is a piece of human psychology to feel that way. It is, you know, anybody who's got kids has seen this with kids. Kids regard everything as zero sum, you know, and so yeah, I do think the Democrats are a little worse, but it's a low bar, you know. That contest. Oh yeah, that was something I said years ago in Parliament of Horrors. That giving money and power to politicians is like giving whiskey and car keys to teenage boys. You know, I'll hold with that. Okay, hold on a second. One second. Let's get the microphone up here. She's moving fast.
You talked about free markets, but I see that same 100 corporations are now more or less taking over America. Every shopping mall looks the same. Every neighborhood little mall has the same store, same chain everything. America is becoming extremely uniform, partly because of the few corporations taking over everything. And although it might be efficient, it's kind of aesthetically and morally somewhat disconcerting.
Well, I agree that it's disconcerting, it's unpleasant looking and so on, but I don't agree that it's just a couple corporations. I mean, some of the biggest corporations that exist right now didn't exist at all 10 or 15 years ago. And some of those, you know, sir, it's easy to say, oh, the Gap is taking over all of America, except that the Gap is falling flat on its face. You know, these things change. They change. We go through periods of consolidation where we get large, you know, big block stores like Target and Walmart and Kmart, and we think, oh, you know, there'll never be another small store. And then we walk down the street and we see like 200 boutiques because they're obviously things that Walmart doesn't do. The important thing here is freedom. The important thing is, are you free to start another corporation to compete with these people or are you not? You say, oh, I can't do it. They've got too much money. Well, they don't have too much. I mean, you know, Michael Dell didn't think that they had too much money. Bill Gates didn't think that they had too much money. You know, Toyota didn't think that GM and Ford and Chrysler had too much money for them to go into the American. You remember you guys are from California. You remember the first Toyota cars that came over here? They were hilarious. They were just hilarious. I mean, they're really like tin cans. I mean, they made Volkswagen Beetles look substantial, you know. And they had names like the Go Baby Butterfly, you know, and the Little Purple Bird, you know. I mean, the Japanese had no idea what they were doing when they came over here, but it didn't stop them from trying. The important thing there is the freedom. Yeah, I mean, Smith wasn't under the impression that corporations are good or that businesses are good. Quite the contrary. He said members of a trade, people in the same trade, never get together, even socially, except that it turns into a conspiracy against the public. You know, I mean, he was very clear-eyed about this. The important thing is the freedom. You have the freedom to start another better-looking mall, you know, that serves people who want the kind of things that you want, you know. And if you're right about that, if it is discouraging the way every mall looks alike and every store seems to be some sort of, you know, then you'll get rich, you know. If you're wrong, you won't. But, you know, the important thing is that you've got that freedom. Let's see. If Smith is right and trade is mutually beneficial, why should U.S. policymakers worry about China? Well, they shouldn't, I don't think. You know, don't the Chinese and the 80s Japanese and the Americans benefit from international trade? And then something about is deficit or whether there's a deficit or a surplus. Well, as I said, with trade, there never is a deficit or a surplus. A trade is a trade. It's a trade is balance. Trade's a trade's a trade. And so, but the fact that what we've traded the Chinese is a lot of debt instruments, and they hold those debt instruments, and we could say, oh my gosh, you know, what if they like get rid of all those bucks? Our dollar that's been so strong could suddenly become very weak, and everything here would get all the imported stuff would get very expensive. Yes, that's true. However, as I read through all the op-ed page stuff in the New York Times and you know, the other big broadsheet papers and so on, everybody is panicking about all this stuff that we've got because the dollar's too strong. They're saying the dollar's too strong. The dollar's too strong. We're importing all this cheap stuff. It's destroying our jobs here. But the main reason we're worried about the dollar being too strong is that it might suddenly get too weak. I'm going, make up your mind. You know, what is it you want? You want a strong dollar or a weak dollar? Well, how about just staying out of it, you know, and letting the marketplace figure this out, you know? I think that, you know, I mean, if the dollar goes down in value, it will cause serious dislocations. But that's, you know, creative destruction. That's the nature of capitalism, you know. I mean, that if you want to live in a stable society, go to North Korea, you know. Stably miserable. One more question. We have one more question in here? Or if not, we'll take there. There's one back there. Wait for the mic.
I think this current administration is such an odious disaster at so many levels, but I'm actually interested from a property rights standpoint. With the Republican administration that's so explicitly against having rights for gay and lesbian people where property rights are conferred in this society, how do you think, separate from, I'm not asking what Adam Smith's view would be on homosexuality, but with regard to property rights that are conferred at this policy level, how do you think we respond to the irrationality of this administration in that regard?
Well, yeah, this administration is very bad about this. I mean, say, for instance, the issue of gay marriage. Now, marriage has got entirely two entirely separate aspects to it. One of them is religious, if indeed you believe in a religion. You know, I mean, it is the spiritual bonding of two souls into one, et cetera. I'm a Catholic. I go along with that. The other side, on a political side, marriage is a contract. And why any two people shouldn't have equal contract rights, you know, if they're, you know, I can't imagine, you know. Now, of course, part of the problem is prejudice, is bigotry, is short-sightedness on the part of political conservatives. But part of the problem is also the activists, because activists have not, in general, been satisfied with getting just the contractual rights. They say, no, we won't be fully equal in the society unless we have unless it is called and regarded as a marriage. Well, it isn't actually within the capability of political society to make that change in people's minds. That is a social, a religious, an extra-governmental decision whether two gay people who intend to stay together forever, whether they are in fact married, is something people have to decide for themselves. It's not something the government can decide. The government only covers contractual law. Now, I would say most of the fault here is on the part of the social conservatives within the politically. You know, I mean, there's the body of people who are political conservatives, not all of whom are social conservatives, but the social conservatives within that body of political conservatives bear most of the blame for the situation. But there is some blame in the insistence in the insistence common to activists in any field. That no, we don't want a reasonable solution to this that people can accept. We will not be satisfied with anything short of perfection, and so, you know, we see the same thing on the right to life issue. As both sides seem to be locked into, if we can't have it completely our way, you know, we refuse to. And of course, the democracy just doesn't work like that. Thank you.
For those of you who don't have copies of PJ's book, we have copies upstairs. PJ would be delighted to sign copies for those of you who don't already have signed copies. One of the questions was raised about Guatemala. I might mention that we have a book called Liberty for Latin America by one of our senior fellows, Alvaro Vargas Llosa, that deals directly with that question, and I think you'll find that of use. You'll also find other of our books here. This is one by one of our senior fellows, Bob Higgs, who spoke here last time, called Against Leviathan, and others. And I want to thank you all for joining with us and making our event so successful. And I want to thank PJ again for his work. PJ is a witty and funny guy, but he's speaking some serious issues. So would you join me again for another... So thank you all for joining with us, and we look forward to seeing you next time. Good night.
Excuse me. You didn't give him my question, so I wonder if I could ask him.
Yeah, please.
Yes.
Yeah.
Here.
Oh.
I'm right here.
What do you think about the...